This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And that is the question of the misunderstanding. I was going to say of the role of simcha, of joy, in Jewish life. But I think more accurate is to say the misunderstanding of the nature of joy in Jewish life. What Jewish simcha really is. And there's a lot of conflicting concepts in the whole thing, and one needs to sort it out and to understand it. Firstly, I mentioned last night that the danger exists that what happened to the word love in the English language in the last 20 years is going to happen to the word simcha in the Hebrew language. It's going to become hackneyed and overused to the point where it doesn't mean anything anymore. As I gave the example, you have a little lady patting her little puppy and saying, "Oh, little Fifi, I love you, I think you're just so beautiful." Then she turns to her husband and says, "I love you too." And it just, what does it mean? What does that word love mean? It's just a word which has come to be used so easily that it has lost its meaning totally. And the English language has not found another word to replace it, with a consequent result that there is no word that a person can use to say, just to say, "I love you." That it should mean anything more than a relationship between a man and his puppy. And there isn't a word to say it. And likewise, in the Hebrew language, the danger exists that all too quickly the concept of simcha is going to become hackneyed and overused. The reason for that is quite easy to understand, and that is that we're living in a time where there's not all that much simcha in the world. There's not that much to celebrate. There's not that much to get happy about. One only has to see how the world tags on to any situation of simcha to realize how thirsty the world is for simcha. Whenever there's any national celebration or time for great celebration, everybody goes crazy because it's something so unusual, huh? And the tendency exists to jump on the bandwagon and to convince people that Torah has just that which everybody's looking for, namely simcha. And it's right, it does have that. But what the world thinks the word simcha means is not what the Torah thinks it means. And we run the risk altogether because we're living in a time where I think never before on such a scale, worldwide, has there been such an industry of spreading Torah. It's become an industry already. It's not just a mission. It's an industry that people earn their living that way. Many people, they're in very large institutions that are built for that. There are people already who earn their living out of putting up buildings for it. It's a business already. It's a big industry. The business of selling Torah. In the old days, it wasn't necessary. People were born into Torah, and those that weren't born into Torah used to come and get it if they wanted it, and if they didn't, they didn't. But this whole concept of going out and selling Torah, and it's a wonderful thing, and that way a lot of people have got to Torah who otherwise would never have got to it. But nevertheless, it has become an industry, and again, the danger exists. That when you're selling something, you try and convince the person that what you're trying to sell him is what he wants. You don't always find that you can tell him what it really is, because he might not buy. And that danger has to be watched terribly carefully, that in our effort to bring Torah to the people, we don't in any way distort or change one letter of the Torah. Rather, don't buy. If you don't like what the Torah says, you're not ready for it yet. So hang on a while. That chas v'sholom, God forbid, that one should change one letter of the Torah in order to accommodate what somebody wants to hear. That we will never do. And the area in which that tendency exists most dangerously is in the area of simcha. Everybody wants to be happy. So it's very easy to sell Torah as just being something which is simcha, and that's the end of the story. And it provides the simcha that you're missing, and so on and so forth. Hasimcha hazois, says Rabbeinu Bechaim in the Kadar Kemach, ki mitzvah min hatzoira. This is a mitzvah d'oraisa. To have simcha is a mitzvah d'oraisa, the same as there's a mitzvah to put on tefillin, and there's a mitzvah to keep Shabbos, and there's a mitzvah to keep kashrus, and there's a mitzvah to build a sukkah on sukkahs. So there's a mitzvah to have simcha. One has to be I don't want to use the word be happy, because as you'll see as we go on, that's not what it means. But there's a mitzvah to have simcha. Ki hi avoido gemuro l'Hashem yizborach. Because this is complete dedication to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Chashuva yoyser min ha-mitzvah. It is more important than the mitzvah itself. That's a sweeping statement. That if you do a mitzvah, if you keep your Shabbos with simcha, the simcha is more important than the Shabbos that you're keeping. Of course, you can't do it without keeping the Shabbos. You can't just have the simcha and go to business happy because it's Shabbos today and say, well, I'm happy it's Shabbos, so the simcha is bigger than the mitzvah. That, of course, not. We're talking about simcha in doing the mitzvah. And if there is simcha in doing the mitzvah, then retrospectively what God values even more than the mitzvah itself is the simcha that went with the mitzvah. Omnam, however, matzinu simcha asuro midin ha-toiro. One also finds a simcha which is prohibited, which one isn't allowed to participate in according to the Torah. Vehi ha-simcha b'ta'anuge ha-guf uv'ta'avosof. And that is the simcha that is stimulated by physical desires and pleasures. And that puts us in very dangerous ground. Because simcha is an emotion. And it's not that easy an emotion to just turn on and off at will. And it's not that easy an emotion just to control and to direct. And we have a situation where it's an emotion which, if it's a simcha shel mitzvah, which we will have to define and understand, if it's simcha involved in a mitzvah, it's the greatest mitzvah there can be. It's greater than the mitzvah itself. And if it's not simcha shel mitzvah, it's a very serious avera. One isn't allowed to do it at all. So when you're in a state of simcha, you must know that you are either doing something very wonderful or something very terrible. But it's not something in the middle. Simcha is incredibly powerful and incredibly dangerous. What is the simcha shel mitzvah? What is it? How does one achieve it when one's talking about simcha shel mitzvah? How does one achieve it? Perhaps before that, one needs to understand a little bit more clearly the extremes of these two types of simchas. The Rabbeinu Bechaya says, for example, using this principle, he explains a din. There's a very special bracha that we make when you have a new wine. It's a bracha v'atova hametiv. And one of the reasons given in the Gemara for making that bracha is that it's a bracha praising the Ribbono Shel Olam at the time of the destruction of Beitar. After Beitar had held out for 3.5 years against the Romans, they were finally wiped out by the Romans. And that happened on Tisha B'Av. Beitar fell on Tisha B'Av. And it was only on Tu B'Av, it was only on the 15th of Av, that 6 days later, that the Jews were able to get to Beitar to bury the bodies. And during that time, everything was just left lying over there, and the Jews were terribly, terribly upset about it, and it bothered them tremendously. But that's how things were left. And when they came to bury the bodies, they found that nothing, there'd be no decay and no deterioration. Everything was exactly as it had been left. And they immediately created the bracha of Hatov V'Hametiv, the bracha of thanksgiving to the Ribbono Shel Olam, for having looked after the bodies for the 6 days, and having enabled them to come to the bodies to bury them 6 days later. And the Rabbeinu Bechaya says, why make that bracha when you're drinking wine? And he answers, because when you're changing wines, when the new types of wines coming onto the table all the time, that's certainly a place of simcha. And that spells danger. Where there is simcha, there is danger. There's danger in the simcha itself, that the emotion is not going to be a good and a constructive emotion. There's a danger that in doing that, one's going to behave in a way which is not in accordance with the way one should behave. One's not going to behave as if one is in the presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam. There is danger one is going to say things one shouldn't say. One is going to do things that one shouldn't do. They might be relatively small things, but they're serious. There's tremendous danger at a time of simcha. And therefore, they were metakim, they introduced the bracha of Hatzoi V'Hameti, that at the time of drinking the wine, you should remember that a lot of people died, and that the Romans used to fertilize the vineyards with the blood of the people who died in Beitar. And that's the only time that in Torah we find a link between blood and wine. It's the only time, very different to the Christian link. It's because of what the Romans did, that when you're drinking the wine, you sort of look at it and you see this red wine and you remember that wine was made with Jewish blood. A little bit different to the story that used to go around in the shtetl. about being wine being made from non-Jewish blood. There were vineyards and vineyards that were actually fertilized for years afterwards with Jewish blood. And that's what you remember. As you hold your wine and you're about to put it into your mouth, you just remember that. And that calms you down. That settles you down a little bit. And why is it so important to settle you down, and more difficult to understand? Why use a brocha to make you miserable? Where do we find such a thing? Normally, even when you have bad news and you say, Baruch Dayan Emes, you're saying it, you're praising the Ribbono Shel Olam for doing something good. The idea of the brocha is not to make you sad. Where do we find such a thing? A brocha to make you sad. But Rabbeinu Bechaya says at the end, Umimashi yadua ki hanefesh b'toich haguf b'dimyon haner hashoich in toich hanevel. The concept of the soul inside the body is much like a candle inside a jar, inside a earthenware jar. Lo yoir oiroi ad shitibaka hanevel. You will get no benefit from the light. The light will not be able to radiate until you smash the jar. Ki yitztorech odom lahachnia ulashaber gufoi b'ta'avosov. A person has to subject and ultimately shatter his physical tendencies. One has to understand what all this means. It's not quite as thunder and lightning as it sounds. And the chomer ha'ofer, his physical being, must eventually lose its strength. And only then can the soul go up to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Already we're getting an idea of the meaning of death. That it's only the soul can only go to the Ribbono Shel Olam when the body decays. You've got to smash that body before the soul can really go where it has to go. That's what Shlomo said when he says, we say this at funerals. And the dust will go back to the earth where it was, and the spirit will go to Hashem who gave it. Biyuroi, that means, when a person is able to subject his physical being right down to the level of the ground, then one's spirit can soar upwards to the Ribbono Shel Olam. So as tinchal hachayim, and then life can be experienced. And the goodness and eternal simcha which will never end. What the Rabbeinu Bechaya has put forward here is that the concept of death is something which has to take place already during life. Death is not the end of everything. Death is, finally, the spirit has been able to relieve itself of this awful burden called the body, and now it can soar, now it can go and do what it wants to do. And in a life situation as well, one has to ensure that in terms of one's desires and one's ambitions, along the lines we talked about last week, in terms of one's desires, one's physical desires, those desires which are motivated purely by the fact that I am physical, those desires that are not motivated by a spiritual being in me, those desires need to be completely shattered ultimately. And only then can one experience full simcha, can one experience full joy. The two don't go together. It's like water and air in a glass. Fill it up with water, the air goes out. Fill it up with air, the water goes out. They don't work together. You can't have the body and the spirit happy simultaneously. Or you can, but not by physical happiness. And that the human being has to actually subject is the right word, not kill. One doesn't kill anything, that's suicide. Otherwise it would be a mitzvah to commit suicide. One has to be very careful in understanding this correctly. You can say, Rabbeinu Bechaya says, you've got to kill yourself before you can achieve anything. So you've got to commit suicide. Chas v'sholom. It's a question of subjecting one's physical being totally to the wills and the desires and the needs of one's spiritual being. That's it. And then one's spiritual being can derive a lot of fulfillment and satisfaction. And one has to be very careful, because if one goes out to a discotheque on a Saturday night, mahavdil between those who are here and those who are not, there's no way that can be a spiritual pleasure. Can't be. And there's no way that at the time of feeling whatever pleasure one's meant to feel at the discotheque, that you can feel spiritual pleasure at the same time. It's not possible. You can't stand in a discotheque with what goes on over there and all the lights flashing and the music in the background and think of Dalif Neymiatayim, know who you're standing in front, and Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Tomid, I always put the Ribbono Shel Olam before. You can't do it. You'll spoil your fun and you'll spoil your religion. So you've got to forget about the Ribbono Shel Olam for a while. You've got to get loose, you've got to let go a little bit. That's the only way you can experience that kind of simcha. And that one isn't allowed to do. And likewise, if you come into a shul, you can't start discotheking around, even if it's Simchas Torah or Purim, because the two just don't go together. What we did discuss last night is also the question of the grey area, which is so much of what we do, where you like to believe that the simcha you're experiencing is in fact a spiritual pleasure, but is it? You're sitting around the Friday night table and you're having a few l'chaims and you're happy. What are you happy for? Shabbos or the whiskey made you happy? If the whiskey made you happy, it's an isu d'oraisa. If Shabbos made you happy, it's a mitzvah d'oraisa. Go and know which it is. It's not that easy. All I say is that one has to be on quite some level. We're not talking about just having a little schnapps to help one relax. That is the concept of kiddush. You start off Shabbos, you drink wine. We use wine for that. But in certain measures, it's controlled. One's at a wedding, and one's singing, and one's dancing, and one's happy. Is one happy because of the mitzvah of being the Sameach Chosen B'Kalo? Is that what I'm happy about, that I'm being able to fulfill the mitzvah? Or am I happy because of who I see there, who sees me there? So friendly, it's a social occasion, again, a little schnapps, a good meal. What's making me happy? If it's the second thing that's making me happy, it's a disu d'oraisa. If it's the first thing that's making me happy, it's a wonderful mitzvah. So we're dealing with the emotion. It can be the same emotion on the surface. It's the emotion of simcha, of happiness. And it can be something terribly serious in terms of it being wrong, and it can be something very great and wonderful. So I wanted to find with you this evening, what is simcha shel mitzvah? How does one achieve it? So I'm going to go off the point for a few minutes. There's a medrash in the beginning of Va'era. The Medrash starts off quoting a pasuk from Koheles. Ufonisi ani, Shlomo HaMelech says, Ufonisi ani lirois chochma v'heilulus besichlus. And I turn myself to examining wisdom and joking around and lightheadedness, foolishness. Ki ma ha'odom sheyovoy achre ha'melech et asher kvar asov. What is man that he should come questioning the king who has already created him? Says the Medrash, HaPosuk HaZeh Ne'emar Al Shloimu V'Al Moshe. This posuk is said concerning Shloimu and Moshe. Al Shloimu Ketzad. How is it said about Shloimu? Keshenoson HaKadosh Baruch Hu Toiro Li Yisrael. Noson Bo Mitzvahs Aser U'Mitzvahs Loisu Aser. When God gave the Torah to the Jewish people, He gave positive mitzvahs and He gave negative mitzvahs. V'Noson L'Melech Mikzach Mitzvahs. And He gave a king some mitzvahs. Shneemar, for example, says, Lo yarbe lo susim, v'kesev azov. He mustn't have too many horses and too much gold and silver. V'lo yarbe lo noshim, v'lo yosu levovoy. And he shouldn't have too many wives, and his heart should not be deviated from the Ribbono shel Olam. Omad Shloimei HaMelech, Shloimei HaMelech got up, v'hichkim al gzeirosu shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he used his brilliance in analyzing the laws of God. V'Omar, and he said, Lama Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Le'yobe Le'Noshim. Why did God say that a king mustn't have too many wives? Lo'y Bishvil Shelo Yosu Levovoy. Certainly the reason was so that they should not detract him from and distract him from his work and from his Avodas Hashem. Ani Arbe V'Libi Le'Yosu. If that's the reason, I'm not worried. I'm of sufficient stature to be able to handle many wives without being distracted from what I need to do. Amru Rabbi Seinu Ba'isa Shoh also Yud Shebi Yarbe V'Nishtat Chalif Ne'akadosh Baruch. At that moment, the Yud in the word Lo Yarbe, he may not have many. That little Yud in that word went before the Ribbono Shel Olam, and he started pleading before God. The Amru and it said Ribbono Shel Olam Lo Yikach Amat Ein Ois Betelu Min HaTorah Lo Olam. Didn't you say that not one letter of the Torah would ever go missing? Hare Shlomo He made a Mevatel Lo Yisi. Shlomo just got up and he struck me out of the Torah. And who knows, so today he knocks out Yud and tomorrow he'll knock out something else. You'll be left with no Torah altogether. How can you allow a man to start messing around with the Torah? Shlomo and another thousand like him may go into oblivion. And just even the little pitzkilo of yourself, of you, Yud, is not going to go. That's there forever. Omer Rabbi Shimon of Marketiv Bay, what is it said about him? That Shlomo finally. Vayehi le'ez zikna Shlomo, and it was when Shlomo got old, Noshov hitu es levovo. His wives distracted him a little bit, they moved him aside. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Noach loy lishloimo sheyehe geiref bivin, sheloy nichtav alov amikro hazeh. Shlomo would rather have been a drain cleaner. He would rather have been a sewage cleaner. And in those days they didn't used to call them sanitary engineers. They used to call them just plain sewage cleaners. He would rather have been a cleaner of drain pipes than that this pasuk should have been written on him. Well, the kach omar Shlomo, that's why Shlomo said alatzmo about himself, ufanisi ani liros chokhba v'das hodulus v'sichlus, and I turn myself to trying to understand wisdom and knowledge and lightheadedness and foolishness. Omar Shlomo, Shlomo meant to say, Mashayisi machkim al divrei Torah. This that I was trying to become clever in Torah. But you see, Mari latzmi shani yodea das ha Torah. And I showed myself as if I knew the reasons for the Torah. Oiso habino v'oiso hadas. That wisdom and that knowledge shall hoilulus besichvus hoyut. It was lightheadedness and foolishness. It was nonsense. That's what the Medrash says. It's a long Medrash that goes on with other things, but that's what it says that concerns us. It's very difficult to understand that Medrash because the Gemara in Shabbos says something completely different on Daf Nun Vav Amud Beis. Omar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmeni, Omar Rabbi Yonason, Kol ha'omer Shlomo Echoto Eino Elotoya. Anybody who says that Shlomo HaMelech sinned is making a big mistake. How could the Gemara say that? We're told that Shlomo in his old age, that his wives moved him aside. No, says Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmeni in the name of Rabbi Yonason. The heart of Shlomo was not as perfectly with God as was the heart of David his father. So Rabbi Yonason is medayik, he deduces from that. He wasn't like his father David, but he didn't sin. It doesn't say that he sinned, it just said he wasn't quite on the level of David HaMelech. David was an incredible tzaddik. Of immense stature. And it says Shlomo wasn't quite like David. But that doesn't mean that he sinned. What does it mean then when it says that when he was old his wives distracted his heart? Answers the Gemara, that you have to answer like Rabbi Noson, who said and it was when in his old days that his wives distracted him to go after foreign gods, but he didn't go. It doesn't say he did anything wrong, it just says his wives distracted him. But it doesn't say he went. Now the Gemara is very difficult. If he didn't go after his wives, and he wasn't really distracted, it's just that they distracted him, but he didn't do anything wrong, why does it say Shlomo would rather have been a cleaner of drains than to have such a pasuk said about him? What did he do wrong? So the Alter von Slabodka says that clearly Shlomo HaMelech Chas V'Shalom didn't do one thing wrong. There's no question about that. There's no question that there wasn't a moment that Shlomo HaMelech considered even doing anything that was 1 degree off straight. Gemara itself says further down, what does it mean? That he heard his wife saying things, v'loy mocha, and he didn't stop her. The Alter von Slabodka talks about the power of shmiya, of hearing something. That whether you like it or not, what you hear penetrates more than anything else. We discussed once in the Motzei Shabbos many years ago the difference between the sense of vision and the sense of hear. What you see and what you hear. And it's a whole theory that I've got generally, that whatever is in a physical sense, it's based on theories which are written, that whatever is in this world is in the spiritual world as well. And I think one can apply that too in the sense that whatever a human being, however he functions in a physical sense, in a spiritual equivalent, he functions in the same way. Yeah, we've often talked about that, the difference between man and woman, that man gives and a woman receives, that's the way they're made physically, and that's how they operate spiritually and emotionally on every other level too. If one looks at what vision is and what hearing is, firstly, vision is a sort of illusionary wave. It's not real things moving. I don't know what it is. I don't know if they know what it is, really, what these waves are. But it's nothing that you can really pinpoint and say that sensing is really making a wave. It is making something. It's an energy thing. That it's not anything really, something. It's not something which is physically real. Whereas sound waves is real movement. Something is really moving. Something is really happening in a very physical sense. Vision, all you can see is the surface. Sound, you can hear beneath the surface. We'll discuss that in a moment. Vision just makes an impression on the retina. That's all it is. You see something, and it makes a sort of illusionary impression. Again, you're not seeing the real thing. You're seeing reflections of light. And through the reflections of light, you can understand, you can figure out what the real thing is. But what you're seeing is not the real thing altogether. And then it's converted into all sorts of nerve waves and things, and your brain starts interpreting it. But nothing really comes inside you. You're seeing illusions. You're seeing reflections. With sound, those sound waves actually go inside your ear. The only other thing that happens with is the sense of smell, where you actually absorb particles into your body in order to be able to experience the sense of smell. But touch is superficial. Sight is superficial. Sound is penetrative. It actually comes inside. And the same way as in a physical sense, everything you hear penetrates into your skull, whether you like it or not. If you've heard it, it's in your head, physically. There is a sound wave, there's movement taking place inside your head. You can't say, I didn't hear it or it didn't affect me. Physically it affected you. There are vibrations in your head, yes or no? Of course there are. Likewise, we have to know that spiritually and psychologically, whatever you've heard is in your head and it's affected you. That's the power of shmir, it's the power of sound. So it penetrates much deeper than sight. And it comes from much deeper than sight. Sight, as I mentioned, all you can see is the surface. Unless the surface is transparent, you cannot see beneath the surface. Sound, so in other words, if you make a veneer, you can change what you like behind the veneer and sight will not show the changes. By sight you won't be able to see it. With sound you'll be able to detect any change, even deep below the surface. You'll tap the thing and it will give a different sound if something of the material has been changed. Listen to the sound that it makes. The sound will change with any little change. Maybe not everybody's ear is sensitive enough to pick up the very minute changes. But in fact, every little change, even deep beneath the surface in the texture of the thing, far beneath the area that you can see, can be sensed. That change can be picked up by a change in sound. When you're listening to sound, sound is not something which is created by the surface of an instrument or by the surface of an object. Sound is created by the whole being of it, everything of it. A violin is not the strings which make the sound. It's the string together with the wood and together with everything that goes into it is making the sound. Change one little thing on the violin and the sound will be different. And so it is with everything that one hears. So, sound comes from depths and penetrates into depths. That is the nature of sound. It comes from something very deep and it goes into something very deep. Now we learned in the Vilna Gaon this afternoon that the koil is megale the lev, the sound reveals the heart. And the heart, the sound doesn't necessarily reveal the heart. What do we mean by echad befev, echad belev, that one can say one thing in one's heart and one thing in one's mouth? The easiest way of fooling people is to tell them lies, to say something which you don't feel. What does it mean that the sound is a revelation of the heart? Oh, the Vilna Gaon didn't say that words are the revelation of the heart. Words you fool people with. The sound of the words. Listen to the tone. That you can't fool somebody with. Listen to the quality of the voice. Listen to the nervousness. Listen to the vibrations. Listen to the expression. That you can't fool somebody with. That's Megale the Lev. The way a person speaks is what you've got to listen. I think I gave you the example some time ago that when I got engaged, I was considering getting engaged, obviously went to discuss it with my rabbeim. So one of them said, come. He said, I've got to go to Tel Aviv. We're in Yerushalayim. He says, come in the bus and we'll discuss it. So we get into the bus and he starts asking me all sorts of irrelevant questions. I'm asking big matters here about whether it's a good shidduch or it isn't. And he's asking me what color clothes does she like to wear and what color hair she got and where does she live and where did she go to school and does she like scrambled eggs or fried eggs. And so I answered, went right through. At the end of it, he says, yeah, good shidduch. I said, but you didn't ask me one relevant question. What do you know, good shidduch? He says, no. He says, all the things is that I know that you've checked out all the important things. He says, I know you. So that you've checked out that it's good, that I know. The only thing I wanted to see is, do you love her or not? And I wanted to see how you talk about her. I didn't even hear the answers. Do you think I care whether she likes scrambled eggs or fried eggs? I wanted to see how you answered the question. Were you excited when you answered, or did you answer with a bored expression? That's what I wanted to see. He was listening to the kol, not to the words. And we did in the ladies' shul last week, where Shmuel comes to Shul and he says, listen, lekol divrei Hashem. Listen to the voice of the words of Hashem. Doesn't say listen to the words. Words are easy to misunderstand and the words are easy to fool somebody with. If you really want to understand what somebody is saying, listen to the voice. Forget the words. Listen to the kol. And the kol is megale the lev. The kol will tell you what's right deep inside. That's the nature of sound. And that's why dvarim shebelev, the dorash hayotzim in alev, nechnotzim in alev. Things which come from the heart go into the heart. Sound. The quality of sound comes from the depths and from the hearts of a person or from an instrument, and it penetrates into the depths of a person and an instrument. Compare the thrills of seeing beautiful art and hearing beautiful art, hearing beautiful music. In terms of the emotional effect on one, there's no comparison. The music moves one much more than the visual arts move one. One has to work on the visual arts in order to understand it. One has to analyze it, one has to figure it out, but one doesn't get immediately emotionally moved by it. Whereas by sound and by music, one can be uplifted or depressed or whatever it is, instantaneously, directly, just because the sound comes from the depths and penetrates into the depths. And says the Alter from Slabodka, Shlomo HaMelech, of course it never entered his mind to change one thing or to do anything wrong, but he heard his wives talking. And it got to the point where he didn't stop them. He talks about what was their intention. What was his intention in marrying these wives? What do you think? Shlomo HaMelech needed all these women around him. With Shlomo HaMelech, he felt that his wisdom was such that this was an opportunity to convert the whole world to monotheism. Not to Yiddishkeit, because there's no need to convert people to Yiddishkeit. But to convert the whole world to monotheism and to morality. And he felt the way he would do it was that if he established relationships with princesses of all the nations of the world, and they became impressed with him, as a result of that, they would be able to convert their whole nation. And so he took the most favored princesses of each nation, the real heroines of the nation, and he married them, converted them and married them, so that they should write home about this wonderful thing called Yiddishkeit and monotheism and Shlomo HaMelech, and as he was able to impress the queen of Egypt, even in an hour of contact with him, she went away, and she was a very clever woman. She went away just eating out of the palm of his hand. And so that was his intention. It was 100% L'shem Shemayim. And whatever he listened so that he could answer them. They gave him their reasons for believing in idolatry, and he had to train them and answer them and educate them. Says the Alter from Slabodka, you can say what you like, and he did it L'shem Shemayim 100%, and he was the most brilliant man that ever was. And he was 100% committed to the Ribbono Shel Olam. But not like David. Why? What was missing? He had heard it, that's all. He had heard things which David never even heard. And if everything you hear penetrates inside your skull and it's there, whether it affects you or not, it does affect you. At least as much as there comes a time once when Shlomo HaMelech didn't say to one of his wives, don't you dare say that in my house. Once he omitted to say that. Why? Because of the effect, even in somebody as great as Shlomo HaMelech, of constantly hearing things and having them penetrate. And therefore, that's why it says the Alter from Slabodka in Pirkei Avos, we're warned to keep away from bad neighbors. It's not bad friends. There's somebody else who holds that you must keep away from bad friends. But the one time, I think it's Rabbi Yossi, holds that you must keep away not only from bad friends, but even from bad neighbors. So it says the Alter from Slabodka, I understand why you've got to keep away from bad friends, but why do you have to keep away from bad neighbors? You don't have to have any, if they're not your friends. You don't have to have anything to do with them. And if they are your friends, then it's included in the other statement of keeping away from bad friends. So he says, neighbors, you're here. That's what's bad about neighbors. You're here. And to hear things from bad people already affects you. A neighbor plays his radio loud, he plays his television loud. The kind of things that he plays are not the kind of sound waves you want in your home. The shouting that you might hear between a husband and wife, a neighbor, is not the kind of shouting you want to hear in your home. The language that they might use, the neighbor might use, is not the language you want to hear in your home. Not that it's going to affect you directly, not that because they swear you're going to start swearing. It's just you don't want those sound waves to penetrate your skull. We're very careful about what we eat, because what we eat is absorbed into our bodies. What we hear is also absorbed into our bodies. It's completely absorbed and assimilated. Whether you like it or not, it's there. And that's how the Altos and Slabotkis mefarish this midrash. The Torah says in this week's Sedra, second paragraph of the Shema, V'hoyo im shomoya tishmu el mitzvesai, and it will be if you will surely listen to my mitzvahs, asher anochi mitzaveh eschem hayom, which I'm commanding you today, li'avos Hashem elokeichem ulo'ovdoi, to love Hashem your God and serve Him b'chol levavchem v'chol nafshichem, with all your heart and with all your soul, then v'nosati mitaratzachem, the rain will come at the right time and you'll flourish and you will have brocha, blessing. Says the Or HaChaim, v'hoyo im shomoya, peirush v'hoyo, what does the word v'hoyo mean? Loshoin simcha. Means simcha. Which is a strange thing to say, because v'hoyo means and it will be. But that's based on a medrash at the beginning of Megillas Esther, in the psicha of the medrash Rabbah, where Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says that wherever the word v'hoyo appears, it connotates simcha. Where it says v'yehi, it connotates ill-being. V'yehi b'mei Achashverosh. Whenever it uses the word v'yehi, there's something negative about it. When it uses the word v'hoyo, the two words mean the same. V'yehi and v'hoyo mean the same. But when the Torah chooses to use the word v'yehi, there is a connotation of sadness, of failure. And when the Torah chooses to use the word v'hoyo, there is a connotation of simcha. And that's why the Or HaChaim says here, v'hoyo im shomoya peirush v'hoyo. What does the word v'hoyo mean? Lo shoin simcha. It means simcha. Utnaihu hadover, and this is a condition. Im tihiyah simcha shel mitzvah. If the simcha is going to be simcha of mitzvah, that's what it means. V'hoyoim shomoya tishmu el mitzvoisai. If you will listen to my mitzvahs, and there will be simcha with those mitzvahs, then I will give you the rain and the good life, and everything will be wonderful. It's an interesting pshat. It's different to everybody else's. What does it mean, v'hoyo? What's the simcha involved here? And here we have the key to it. It says the Or HaChaim, v'hoyo means that if there will be simcha shel mitzvah. Now what is simcha shel mitzvah? The Torah tells us. Im shomaya tishmu el mitzvosai. If you will listen to my mitzvahs. I want you to try and understand something. Imagine you'd never heard music before. And I took you and I started telling you about how wonderful music is and the violins. You must just hear the sound of violins. And chillers, and the sound of the brass, and the woods, and the way they intermingle and harmonize with one another, and I really get your tongue hanging out to hear this unbelievable sound. And then I take you along to the city hall there, and before the concert, and I show you, that's a violin. And you look and you say, disappointed, that you can't hear anything. The musicians aren't there, the instruments are just lying on the stage. I say, that's a cello, and that's a bassoon, and that's an oboe. There you've got a trumpet, and there you've got a French horn. Beautiful, isn't it? You say, no, not. Those are the mitzvahs. The mitzvahs are the violins, and the cellos, and the bassoons, and the oboes. Those are the mitzvahs. But that can't bring you to simcha shel mitzvah. So I say, go and try it. Go ahead. So you pick up the violin, you look at it, and you touch it, and you don't know what to do with it. Still no simcha shel mitzvah. And if you go a step further and you actually hold the violin the right way and you take the bow and you try and you play a little bit, you'll make a sound which certainly is not going to be any simcha. So you say, well, I don't know what you've been misleading me for all this time. This wonderful violin, the wonderful sound, listen to it. Then I say to you, wait, now sit down and listen. And then Isaac Stern comes on the stage and he picks up his violin and you hear, oh, that's a violin. That's the simcha of the violin. When we talk about the simcha of a mitzvah, that's what we're talking about. If you would listen to the mitzvahs, if you would let them penetrate, if you would hear them. V'hoyo im shamaya tishmu el mitzvosai. It doesn't say v'hoyo im tishmeru mitzvosai. If you will keep my mitzvahs, if you will observe my mitzvahs, that's not the simcha yet, just to do them. The simcha comes out of hearing them, out of understanding them, out of listening to them. And what does that mean? That means hearing their depth. Letting the mitzvahs speak to you right from inside. And let them penetrate right inside you. How do we do that? There are two ways. The one way is intellectually. It's possible to do it through understanding them. Because the mitzvahs don't just make music automatically. They only make music if you know how to play them. So one needs to, A, there's no question, one needs to know how to do them. If you don't know the technique of playing the violin, you won't make music, you'll make noise. And if you don't know the technique of keeping the mitzvah, you'll make a noise, you won't make anything, which it is a pleasure and a simcha to listen to. So you need to know exactly how to do the mitzvahs. That's number one. But you need to listen to them. You need to hear them, not just do them. And to hear them, you need to understand what is in the heart of the mitzvah. What the mitzvah is really, what it really stands for, what it's really trying to communicate, what it's really trying to convey. What is Shabbos about? What is Kashrus about? What are the interpersonal laws really about? What does it mean, as we discussed last week, about not wanting something which isn't yours, not forcing somebody to sell something which is theirs and which they don't want to sell, not offering them huge prices even though they agree voluntarily to sell it, it's still wrong. To understand these halachas and to understand these laws in terms of what is the voice underneath the law, what is the real heart, the essence of it, then you can get simcha. And that's why one of the ways of getting simcha is by knowledge. The more you understand about the mitzvah, the more joy the mitzvah brings you. The more you know about the mitzvah, the more joy it brings you. To come to sukkahs, for example, to build your sukkah and to shake your lulav as a routine, that's just the way you saw your father do it, that's no great simcha. The great simcha is when you spent a little while going through the halachas, you know exactly how to do it and what to do, and you have that confidence of knowing that you're doing it exactly right. And you've gone through a bit of the understanding and the background, and you feel you understand the heart of what the mitzvah is telling you as well. Then you're able to hear the music of the mitzvah. Then your sukkah starts playing music and you're able to listen to it and to have simcha. There is a direct one as well, and that is the ability that one can have just emotionally to relate to a mitzvah, provided again it's being done correctly. A mitzvah which is not done correctly is no mitzvah. It's a good intention, but it's no mitzvah. Blow a shofar, but you're not using a shofar, you're using a trumpet, that's no mitzvah. Build your sukkah a week before sukkahs, that's no sukkah. Shake your lulav on Shavuos, that's no lulav. Instead of using a palm tree, using some other tree, it's no lulav. And so with all the details, the mitzvah has to be done correctly for it to be a mitzvah. And once it's done correctly, it is possible to have a feeling of direct emotional fulfillment of hearing the mitzvah talk. It's possible, particularly if one's a sensitive and an emotional person, one can do that. But for that, one needs a bit of a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. One has to hear God talking to one a little bit. Let's sum it up and understand, therefore, that there are two kinds of simchas. I mentioned last night, really, that simcha, joy, comes from the feeling that you're involved in something bigger than you. That's really what brings a feeling of simcha. As long as you feel you're involved in something smaller than you, there's nothing to be happy about. You're wasting time. Simcha comes from the feeling that what you're doing is more important than you. It's bigger than you. It's more tremendous, more inspiring than you yourself. And there are two ways of achieving that. The one is by feeling that you're a nothing, in which case you can play in a sandpit and find simcha. Or by a feeling that although I'm not a nothing, I'm something, I'm a creation of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and a very great creation of the Ribbono Shel Olam, but what I'm doing is still greater. And these two feelings can be contradictory. The discotheque type of simcha is a simcha where really you try and minimize your own feeling of importance. That's really what it is in a sense. Everything becomes meaningless. Everything, you forget all the things which concern you, you forget all the things that worry you, and you forget all the things at which you are no good, and all the things at which you're a failure, and all the things at which you're good also. You just forget everything and you go into an unreal existence. And in that unreal existence, you're irrelevant. And so these lights flash and the music and the rhythm plays to take you out of your normal existence and to place you into an unreal existence where you are nothing. And then whatever you're doing is fun. But if you don't consider yourself nothing, if you consider yourself a human being with an intellect, with pride, with dignity, with responsibility, a creature that's made in the image of the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, who in stature is just a little bit less than godliness itself, and a human being who's capable of achieving godliness, of understanding godliness, if you see yourself as that, and you stop yourself in the middle of the discotheque and say, what am I doing here? That just doesn't go together. If you see yourself as somebody worthwhile, you can't have fun in these lower forms of entertainment. It's not possible. And if you see yourself as somebody great, or as somebody at least potentially great, you can have fun if you're involved in something still greater. And that's the Simcha Shel Mitzvah. But you can't have Simcha Shel Mitzvah unless you appreciate the greatness of what you're involved in. That's why I say it can either be directly emotionally, if you're on that level where you really believe intuitively, because you're born with it. If you really believe intuitively that you are, that Torah is much greater than you, and that every mitzvah is so eternal and wonderful and great, then even without an intellectual system you can enjoy doing the mitzvah. But if you don't have that, you need to understand, you need to do a little bit of studying in order to appreciate how great the mitzvah really is. But what's important to understand is that tzimtzus shel mitzvah is going to come from the hoyo im shemoya tishmu. It's only going to come from allowing the deep voice of the mitzvah to penetrate right into your depth. That's the only way you're going to experience tzimtzus shel mitzvah. And the understanding of the kada kemach at the end, that the two can't go together, and that the human being has to somehow minimize or somehow reduce his physical pleasures and fulfillments in order to free himself to feel the spiritual things. Because it's very difficult, if not impossible, to experience the two together. The Simcha Shel Mitzvah, the greatest Simcha Shel Mitzvah, and I gave the example last night, and I think it's a very relevant example, one that will explain it to you very clearly. The greatest Simcha Shel Mitzvah is to feel yourself in God's presence, in close proximity to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And I gave the example of, if I said to you that tomorrow morning we're taking a flight to London, I have an invitation for you from Her Majesty the Queen. She would like you to spend the week in Buckingham Palace with her as a personal guest. And she intends not only to have you staying in Buckingham Palace, but she intends to spend the whole week with you, and she's going to show you all around England. So if you say to me, the Queen, well, I think I've got time for the Queen, then I've got to say, then, you know, you would be wasting your time going. If that's how you see the Queen, you won't enjoy the week. But if you say, oh, the Queen, me? What? Why have I get an invitation from the Queen? How does she know about me? Who am I? Then you start having simcha. And then off you go to Buckingham Palace and you bow down deep and learn how grateful you are, Your Majesty, for having invited me, and you're on your best behavior day and night. Not one thing, and you keep on checking. How does one eat in front of the Queen? How does one talk? How does one walk? And you ask about protocol. But chas v'sholom, you shouldn't do anything which might be offensive. And you're constantly aware that you're in the presence of the Queen. Now, if you come back and you tell me the story, and I don't know anything about kings and queens, I might say, but well, it must have been miserable. A whole week you had to be dressed properly. A whole week you had to wear all tense in case you did something wrong. A whole week you had to be careful about every word you said. And you said, but you don't understand what an honor it was, what a pleasure. That's what a queen is. If one's in the presence of the Queen, that's how one has to be. But that was the whole thrill of it. And the attention she gave me, it was wonderful. That's how it is with the Ribbono Shel Olam. The more you hold him in awe, the more is the simcha of feeling close to him. The less you hold him in awe, the less is the simcha of feeling close to him. Now, any simcha which requires you to get away from God a bit is not a simcha shel mitzvah, it's a terrible issue. Any simcha which entails and involves a feeling of closeness to God is a simcha shel mitzvah. And that's the test, it's as simple as that. When you're dancing at that wedding, do you see the Ribbono Shel Olam next to you? If you do, it's a simcha shel mitzvah. Are you behaving as though the Ribbono Shel Olam is next to you? If you do, it's a simcha shel mitzvah. Are you speaking as if the God is listening to every word you're saying? If you do, it's a simcha shel mitzvah. And the more you feel struck with awe as being in the presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam, the greater is that feeling of joy of being closer to Him. The more you're attuned to listening to every word, the more the mitzvah means to you, the more His words mean to you, and the more thrill you get out of the words that He says, out of the words of the Torah. And if you need to remove him from your mind a little bit in order to enjoy what you're doing, if you need to just be yourself and be spontaneous and all the other words that they use for what in Torah we call perikas oil, the removal of the responsibility of being a Jew. In the modern world they call that entertainment, they call it taking a break, they call it going away for a weekend to Sun City, they call it all different names for it. What it is perikas oil, that's it. I'm removing the response, leaving the Ribbono Shel Olam at home for a while. It's enough. I just want to get away for a while. Get away from who? Not from the children or from the business. I want to get away from the Ribbono Shel Olam for a while. That you can't do. That kind of simcha you can't have. Not even for one moment. And it doesn't matter if it's on Yom Kippur or if it's on Simchas Torah or if it's on Purim. If the type of simcha you're experiencing is one which is apart from God, that's not allowed. If you do anything that you wouldn't do in the presence of a king, that's not allowed. That's not simcha. And if you're behaving the way you would, even if you are at some city or one of these funny places, but you're behaving the way you would in front of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's good. And so one finds that simcha, true Torah simcha, is not in conflict with awe, with seriousness. I'm not talking about depressiveness and oppressiveness, that not. That we never like. You can't feel oppressed by the Ribbono Shel. If anybody's ever been into St. Peter's, I say if you've ever been in, because I don't think that one should go in. But if you've been in, then you will know what an oppressive feeling of godliness is. I tell you, you're struck by this thing over you. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about being oppressed or depressed. We're talking about, though, being full of awe and seriousness. The same as you would be that week. The fact that the Queen invited you to spend a week with her means you can relax to a degree. She's invited you, you're a friend. So there's that feeling of intimacy with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Yet at all times he's king. It's like one would feel if one's own father was a king. And I really believe that's part of all the halachas of Kibud Av V'Em. That you've got to make a king out of your father so that you can experience a little bit what it is that we're talking about. So you've got the intimacy of a father and the awe of a king. And that's why we say, Avinu Malkeinu, our father, our king. That's the closest we can get to trying to understand what the Ribbono Shel Olam is in relationship to us. We have the intimacy of a close family relationship, father to child, yet melech. My father just happens to be the king. So I can't call him pa, I've got to call him sir. When I'm before him, I've got to be dressed in a certain way. I've got to be polite at all times. When I refer about him to anybody else, I've got to talk about him as his majesty. That's the way I've got to talk. Because my father is also the king. And that's the kind of relationship that one has to develop with the Ribbono Shel Olam. But imagine in a situation where your father is the king and you're able to experience the simcha of that intimacy together with the awe of being in the presence of a king. Is that simcha or is that depressiveness? Well, depressiveness it certainly is. It's certainly simcha, but it's simcha with awe. That's the simcha shel mitzvah. To have the two together. And I've said in the recent days that we've been going into this a little bit, that one has to be very careful, and one often finds the old literature style of Yiddishkeit has been criticized as being depressive and oppressive and all this kind of thing. Chas v'sholom, it never was. These people were always relaxed, they were always pleasant. These literature gedolim and this great Talmidei Chachamim that one would have gone to, or even not the great Talmidei Chachamim, just anybody, would always have received you with a smiling face and an open and outstretched arms. And there would have been a tremendous feeling of simcha, but not the jumping up and down simcha. Quiet, settled, deep, tranquil simcha, which is the real simcha. And together with that, at the same time, you would feel that the Ribbono Shel Olam is there too. At all times, you would feel the Ribbono Shel Olam is there too. There's simcha, but a simcha in the presence of God. And we've also discussed that the deeper the emotion, the more difficult it is to express. Deep emotions cannot be expressed in superficial ways. You can express cheap simcha by dancing. Deep simcha, if one's on a high madrega, maybe also a little bit by dancing, but that alone isn't enough. It's much more difficult to express this kind of simcha. Much more difficult. One can notice it, one can see it, but to really express it is extremely difficult because it's so terribly, terribly, terribly deep. And on another occasion, on another shiur, we'll discuss and go into some detail as to how one does express it and what the ultimate expression of that simcha is. But at the moment, let's just understand that the simcha and the seriousness go hand in hand, and that the expression of that simcha is not easy because of its depth. And that at all times, while ivdu es Hashem besimcha, we're commanded and instructed that there should be simcha in all our service of God. That is simcha shel mitzvah. It's that simcha that goes together with awe and with seriousness. And it is never ever the simcha of prikas oil. Never ever are we allowed to experience simcha at the expense of that relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Rather, the simcha is the feeling of closeness and proximity with He who is both our King and our Father.